This is a Distraction Therapy podcast. Whatever gets you through the day. Hello, it is... I've got to find the date. Let me start again.
13th.
Yeah, it's Wednesday as well, isn't it? It's Wednesday, Wednesday the 13th of January, 2021. And I'm Rob Watson, and this is a Distraction Therapy podcast. And today I'm talking over the internet with a friend of mine who I've not been in contact with for a couple of years, actually, but we see each other on Twitter and places like that. She probably mutes me, so kind of the bombardment of bile that I share and circulate on Twitter. But Kat Thompson, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Nice to speak to you.
And you. Usually start off with, we've just had a quick conversation about the weather, but so go on, let's repeat, get our weather complaints out of the way. Is the weather okay for you at the moment?
No, I'm not looking at the weather today. It's raining, grey. Went out for a walk this morning and it was just starting to rain as we went out. It's been doing it since 11 o'clock-ish. So.
And I think the next 24 hours it's going to be quite heavy as well, isn't it?
Oh, haven't looked.
Well, yeah, from what I've seen on the forecast, it's cold, colder on the East Coast than it is on the West Coast. So you're based in Peterborough, I believe.
Yeah.
So you're going to have a chilly few days, whereas we're kind of in Leicester, kind of sandwiched in the middle. Somewhere.
Yes, yeah, we are a bit drier because obviously we're a bit further east than you, but not that different, I don't think.
Well, you'd be surprised. I mean, it's like you walk, 10 minutes walk down the road, completely different weather pattern around here, so it's never consistent. The idea of this conversation is to just find out how people are and what we've been doing to get us through the lockdown and kind of what things we've been using as our distraction therapy. What have we taken up? So is there anything you've taken up as a new hobby or anything like that? Because we'll talk about photography in a minute, but because that's how we know each other. But have you landed on anything new? Are you now suddenly expert in yoga and Pilates and things like that?
No, I don't think I have taken anything up. It's quite a few things that I sort of projects I've got on the go and things that which I haven't done for a few years that I could take up easily anyway. So I haven't really started anything new. I've worked. I think the two lockdowns are quite different. Obviously, last year it was all new to everybody. The weather was great. We actually had a heat wave in March. Whereas now we are in the depths of winter, and I think it's very different between the two. So, the first lockdown, the garden's never looked so good. I'm still reaping the benefits of actually having had the time to sort the beds out, fruit in the freezer. I think I picked my last red pepper yesterday off the plants. And that was what I think the first lockdown, an awful lot of time spent in the garden.
And are you a natural gardener?
Yeah, I bought the house because it's got a big garden. I've been here 17 years. It was very much a blank canvas. There was a falling down pergola type thing, some grass and a big tree. We've still got the big tree, but the garden's changed. There's vegetable beds, there's flower beds. We've put a greenhouse in. Look, I've just squeezed that one in just before lockdown last year. So, yes, I am. And it was nice to have the time to do it.
And you were a regular at the garden centres, were they? Or is this all DIY?
My husband's done a lot of building. I do tend to sort of go out and come back and find he's built something else in the garden. So there's pergolas, decking and things. So he's done an awful lot. Most of it's self-built. He's done most of the building. He does the building, I'll do the growing.
And would you describe it, I'm trying to build a picture here now in my head, would you describe it as classic and timeless, or is it like something out of a 1990s changing rooms episode?
No, like most things, they're quite, I have sort of quite unique. It's definitely, it's an organically grown garden. Well, it's organic in that I'm too lazy to use pesticides most of the time, but it's grown up over the years. Just I work as a doctor, so obviously time off is actually quite limited, and getting time off to coincide with weather, as we've already discussed, actually has been a bit of a challenge some years. So I'll do a little bit one year, a little bit more the next year, so it's continually evolving, continually changing. We've got sort of projects on at all times. The plants are all herbs, useful plants, is sort of the theme that runs through the whole garden, apart from a couple of beds that have got plants from other countries that I've sort of just sort of special products. So the one that I did last spring was the was a spring bed right at the back of the garden. It's very shaded, and the plants were based on woodland plants that we'd seen on our honeymoon in Slovenia.
Wow.
So that was, it's just a little area.
Have you got that knack of remembering their names and being able to tell? I bet you probably even know the Latin names of them, do you?
Some of them, yeah, I do. You know me well, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember the name. You know, I walk past a flower bed and it's like the names just escape me. It just disappears out of my head.
Yeah, it's all parsley to my husband. It's the big parsley and the little parsley. And yeah.
And how have you resolved the issue of the neighbours' cats?
And that's an interesting one. So we've got a... Most of the garden's bounded by fencing. There's one bit which is a hedge. My husband's put in a sort of mesh net. The cats can still get through. They get over the fences. And it hasn't been a problem, up until the last couple of weeks, when two doors down, friends there have got a new cat that's now allowed out and is finding our garden. So we shall see how that goes.
Yeah. The battle of the cats in the neighbourhood. Yes. Cats. So tell us a bit more about these other projects that you've kind of, have you started them or are you just thinking about getting back into them?
Oh, they're all half done.
That's the best way with a project. It's like ongoing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a couple ones that, my father's a model railway, a railway modeller, and gave me some little men to paint. And a couple of years ago now, which I'd sort of not found the time to. So those are pretty much done now. I've just got to find out what sort of mud he has, or where the railway is supposed to be based, so I know what sort of mud to put on their shoes.
Wow.
Those they're nearly done. I started doing a bit of a stained glass project, but that stalled because I've got a dark room. We had a lot of building done on the house a couple of years ago. And so the dark room is a sort of a workshop thing, but actually it's a little bit cold in the winter. Although it's insulated, there's no heating in it. So any sort of thing like that at the moment is stalled because it's just too cold to really sensibly do much.
Yeah, when you've got to break the ice on the fixer, that's not a good thing, is it?
It's not ideal, no. It's not quite that cold, but it's cold enough for your hands to get.
I used to do my photography in a shed. My brother had built in a house I grew up in. There was a brick shed was built for some reason. I don't know why. I think it was to store his scooter at some point.
Yeah.
And I kind of, there was space in there and a workbench, so I put a dark room in there. So I used to enjoy, you know, kind of nipping out in. And it was like, you know, January, February when it was freezing. So you have to put your fingerless gloves on to.
Yes, yeah, you've got more stamina than I have, I think. That one.
Well, it was 30 years ago, so so the dream to have a house with a dark room again would be nice.
We've put some little one in we've had an outbuilding done when we've had a garret at the back of a garage, and the thought is it can end up as a granny flat if we ever need it to, for aged parents.
Yeah.
At the moment, yeah, dark room. So there's that as well, which I've processed. I had some pictures that I'd taken a few years ago that I'd processed the film, but then never had the space anywhere to do the prints. So I did quite a lot of prints, and I played around with what do you call them? Sort of photograms and cyanotypes as well. I've been playing around with those during the during the first lockdown, because we obviously had a lot of sun.
Cool.
I'm not sure if you've done any of those, but basically
I've not done it now.
Yeah, it's a contact print type process. You paint. I can't remember what the chemicals are. It's a combination of chemicals of iron, cyanide, and things, and the iron in it. It reacts with the UV light, and so you get shadows from whatever you put on your paper.
Leaves and things,
bright sunlight. It can be, it takes 20 minutes on a dull day in the summer. I was leaving them for overnight in the greenhouse to so I've done a bit of that. That's and you can do that either with, as you say, leaves or plants. Sometimes the dyes from the plants actually come through, and then you get other colors. And also you can do it by printing off an acetate of a photo and using it like a negative. So did a bit of that as well.
It sounds like an unplanned integration of gardening and photography.
There's a lot of that goes on. There's a lot of times when I think I should have been gardening and I've been taking photos, or the other way around.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, you see. This is why this is called distraction therapy. So it's as if distraction is, most people think distraction's a bad thing, but I think it's that point where we forget ourselves and we've become distracted, and we realise that we've been sitting on Wikipedia for half an hour looking at, I don't know, Napoleonic soldiers' tunics, buttons, or something like that.
Yes, yeah. Well, I'm a great believer in not planning, not rigidly planning too much, because I do like to leave that little space where the magic can creep in and you think, oh, I've done that instead of doing that, but that's fine. Quite happy.
So what's your photography like? What are you basing that around? Your garden is obviously your dark room. So what other stuff are you doing?
So a lot of it's been garden, playing around with macro, which is something, and abstracts, which is something I've been doing for the last sort of 2-3 years. Particularly the light. I'm really interested in the light, the sunlight. I did a, years and years ago, a City in Guild, and I found my old paperwork recently. Obviously, sorting out's another thing you have time for. And it said, oh, really good portfolio, but please stop taking photos into the sun. So I'm going to have to, this is a big apology. I doubt my tutor from West Suffolk College is listening, but this is a really big apology, because most of my photos seem to be taken into the sun now.
What's wrong with that? What's the...
Nothing at all. I like the effect it has. Your lights and shadows, chiaroscuro. I like playing with that. So that's been a fair bit. And actually, I've sort of done a bit more wildlife photography. Starting off with, we've got bird feeders in the gardens. We have a really big range of birds in the garden, and locally as well. So this says... birds being sort of butterflies and actually dragonflies this year. Those of you who know Peterborough, it's right on the edge of sort of anywhere interesting, and then you sort of get to the hills and then it's flat. But actually the fens are quite fascinating an area. And we've spent a bit of time in the times we've been allowed to go out just exploring the fens, exploring the river washes, and say the dragonflies have been spectacular this year.
Do you find you've become a bit more attentive to what's in front of you? So I take it that you've not like jetted off for a holiday anywhere. I couldn't understand when I see pictures of people going on holidays over the last 12 months. It's like, skiing or something like that. How on earth have they managed to do that? But kind of the local walks. Are you more attentive to what's in front of you?
I think so. Because we've both, being in healthcare, are sort of really acutely aware of, the need for not just lockdown, but keeping away from people, of not transmitting the virus inadvertently. So, we've not not been anywhere since this all started. Because I again, like you, I just cannot understand going to pick up another variant, bring it back to your country. It doesn't compute to me. So I think, so having done a lot more local stuff, what we're finding is we're doing the same walks again and again. And you do, you notice something different every time. There's always something changes. So yes, I think I have become a lot more attentive. And I know if I'm doing a lot of photography, I tend to look with different eyes. Does that make sense? That, you know, you're sort of looking for, if it's bird, if it's, you know, long lens I've got, I'm looking for what birds are around. If not, I'm looking at scenes, shots, shapes, shadows, whatever, patterns, in quite a different way. So I think you're right. I have seem to become a lot more in tune with what's around.
It's that kind of purposeful looking, isn't it? We often kind of get feel that we ought to be, you know, I kind of use Instagram a lot, and you sometimes feel, I like traveling. I've done a reasonable small amount of traveling, you know, I would like to continue to be able to do some traveling, but that kind of, you know, being able to walk out your house and walk around your neighborhood, or, you know, your locality, is to and see and spot things there that are different each time, or which change and adapt, is something we're not really, you know, we're not kind of used to these days, are we? There's not many of us do that kind of stuff.
No, I think you're right. It always amazes me how some people just can be in an environment and just not notice it, not see it at all, and not want to look either. Obviously, they're focused on other things, I guess. But to me, I like to read what's around me, to be able to read the landscape, to read the plants, read the birds, you know what they are. And I think, I know, I mean, I'm not really into mindfulness, but I think that's, you know, part of this, that taking yourself out of yourself into another place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, not focusing too much on what's inside your own head, but
yeah,
having something external to focus, which isn't the bills and which isn't the news and which isn't. What's the environment and its inhabitants been telling you then?
I think it's just feeling part of it, feeling that you're actually in it, that we've got a responsibility to what's around us, to look after it as much as it looks after us. So, you know, we're all just part of one ecosystem. I know that sounds really new agey, but I think that we need to be remembering that a bit more. That this, I mean, it's a really, see, the Fens is a massively man-made landscape. And it's like a big machine, and it just sort of does feel like you're a visitor to a machine. It's a really odd feeling around here. Well, sort of as you start to look and understand how the Fens and the drainage and all that works, and you think, yeah, we really are just a small part of something a lot bigger.
Yeah, it's not necessarily nature, is it? You know, it's a version of nature. You know, it's like,
yeah,
let's go out for a walk in the woods and feel part of nature. Yeah, it's a man-made woods that's designed for cash crops, and
exactly,
you know, and there's no other life in here other than pine trees. It's the paradox, isn't it, of modern life?
It is very much so. But yeah, look carefully enough and you'll find stuff. Peterborough is a funny place. I moved here from sort of Sheffield, and obviously border the Peak District, out in the hills at every opportunity I could. And you move here and it's like, there is nothing here at all. But actually there's quite a lot of things that make you go, ooh, that's interesting.
Anything that stands out? Well, I always like the, that's interesting moment. So,
oh, yes, I do as well. And if I say something's interesting, it's a compliment. So, I don't know, again, sort of how much you've archaeology in that, but Flag Fen it's a mile and a half from the house, and that's maybe a couple of miles. That was a Iron Age roundhouse settlement. And then a mile away from the house is Must Farm, which is where Iron Age boats have been unearthed. It's part of the brick pits. And in the course of digging out the clay, they found what they think was a Lakeland or a Fenland settlement on pilings. The houses were all on pilings, but it's burnt down after not hadn't been inhabited for very long. And it's again, that's really fascinating to read about how this village, the life just stopped. So the bowls have all got the remnants of the food in. And they found a lot of canoes that are almost unique. So there's a lot of archaeology around here. And incidentally, I don't know if you've read the book The Fens, but that's worth a read if you're interested. Written by Francis Pryor, who's done a lot of the digging up of Bronze Age field systems and Iron Age stuff. So that there's quite a lot of that stuff around here. You know, little things like there's two decoy lakes, which are quite rare.
What's a decoy lake?
It's where they used to catch ducks. So it's a star-shaped lake, and you'd put a wicker basket almost into the arms of the star, and then drive the ducks into the basket, and that's how they caught ducks for eating.
Ah, so they didn't actually go chasing after them; they fooled them.
Yeah,
into becoming your lunch.
Exactly, just drove them into the basket and picked the basket up. Yeah, so there's lots of things like that.
And I suppose if things get any worse, we might be calling on those skills again at some point in the future. You know?
Well, yes, yes.
I can't get my shredded duck spring rolls at Marks and Spencer's. So no. Therefore, well, the Fens around the corner. Let's go catch a few.
yes, and I haven't actually worked out how they caught eels yet, but you know that one might be possible as well.
Yeah, probably probably wading with a net, I'd imagine. So.
I think they strung nets across the rivers, I think, is how they did it, but I'm not sure. Yeah, we haven't kind of gotten to that yet.
but now it's that kind of stuff, it's largely mechanised, isn't it? And, the environment, as you say, the environment is kind of, you know, you put a combine harvester through it and you strip away all of the, you straighten out the rivers and you take away all of the shrubbery that was growing up at the side of it. And it's just... You know, the rewilding stuff is quite interesting. So have you been photographing it as well?
Yes, yeah. And it's interesting you say that because the Great Fen Project is not far from, again, it's about 5 miles away, and where there was a fen called Wood Walton, which was owned by the Rothschilds, you know, the family with all the money. And they said, right, we're going to leave this as fen. So it's got some drains which are dead straight, but in between it's as wild as it can be, and that's being joined up with several other areas as a massive rewilding area. And one of those, Home Fen, is just the most brilliant woodlands for photography. So I've managed to get sort of early winter, late autumn, before obviously you're not allowed out, so you've got to stay locally now apparently, but before then I've got down to Home Fen for a couple of photographic trips, and it's best in the morning, it's best to get a sunrise there if you can.
And where are you posting, sharing your photographs online?
Yeah, they're mostly on Facebook. I've got some on Flickr, which I tend to use Flickr as an archive, but I've got a bit behind with Flickr, so most of them go on Facebook, and occasionally they'll go on Twitter. I don't know if you've seen any of them. No, I don't mute you, by the way.
No, there we go. I'm just looking through your Twitter feed now. Yes, very picturesque with the lock. The first, do you like me? Lots of retweets and the waterways and the frozen fields.
Yeah, so the lock is half a mile away. That's Stanground Lock. Which is where the Back River, which is the old course of the Neen, comes off from what is one of the first drains to be cut, which is, I think, 14th century. So the lock is the old Neen as it comes down. And then obviously all the floods as well were a couple of weeks ago. And again, that just... makes such a familiar landscape into something completely alien with all the floodwater, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, I went out the other morning for a walk, and it was kind of nice to be off the roads and it was nice. Is that your squirrel picture? Yes.
It's not our squirrel. No, we do have squirrels, but that's not ours.
Oh, right. Okay, that's a shame. I was going to say it's a good squirrel picture. So excuse me. It's kind of the way I describe it. I was walking through Aylston Meadows, which runs the River Soar runs through the centre of Leicester, and the trees are bare. You've got eight hours sunlight, four of which are prominent, and the rest of it is just murky. But the trees are actually quite translucent with the lichen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different kind of landscape, and you've kind of got to remind yourself to get out. I mean, certainly if you live in the city like I do, when I used to live in Melton Mowbray, it was a lot easier to just get out and 10, 15 minutes later, you were in the fields. Whereas here in Leicester, it does take a bit more effort to get out and kind of see the wildlife.
I mean, we're quite lucky being on the edge of Peterborough, but actually, because of the landscape, there aren't that many footpaths. So we do end up walking along the river. There's about three walks that we can do from the house, with a couple of long ones and a shorter one. But then, as I said, you sort of end up, we were talking about it this morning as we were walking, saying how you end up seeing something different every time. And you think, has that sign been really, really been on that gatepost for the last 6 months that I've walked past it every day?
And you never spot it. You never see it.
No. So, you do have to, I think I'm a big believer in taking what you've got around, using what you've got around you.
Yeah.
It's no point longing for the Lake District or, the big scenes when you can't get there, actually. What you've got.
And sometimes that involves actually getting out of bed a couple of hours earlier and going out before the dawn so you catch the right kind of light. I'm not that dedicated.
I'll do it occasionally, but say only locally. I'm not going to do, not going to do the big ones.
Yeah, so, perhaps if I was staying overnight in the Lake Districts or something, I might, for a weekend there. But, from home, it's like kind of, by the time I've had my three coffees in the morning, it's not...
So
what other stuff have you, where are you drawing your influences from at the moment? Are you, what are the forms of, who are you sharing in terms of photographers? On Instagram, the one I'm sharing at the moment, let me see if I can find it. It's Bill, sorry, all of a sudden you can't find a thing on Instagram when you pull it up. It's just a whim. And then I won't be able to find the one I'm looking for. Let's do a search for it. But Bill Newsinger.
I don't use Instagram.
Oh, right. He's Leicester based, and his black and white photography is just really great. Does a lot on 35mm film.
Right.
So on Instagram, it's Bill Newsinger.
Right. Just Googling him quickly.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
But it's kind of like murky. It's very kind of moody. I grew up doing moody black and white stuff when I was younger. And he really does it 10 times better than I can do it. And it's, it's very lots of very kind of angles on things, which give it a real kind of, you have to look twice at what it is to figure out where he's been and what he's done. So,
Sounds interesting. That, so I like the photos that you have to look at and just say, and work them out. This I find with, because a lot of what I do is landscape, but a lot of what's popular has got the big wow, big impact factor, but actually then nothing else. Once it's hit you, and that's it. I prefer the stuff that grows a bit. It's sort of well-worn name, but David Ward, I like his stuff because it's not so obvious. He looks at sort of the minutiae a lot more. excuse me. I attended a photo conference in November, and actually there were some really interesting people there who I didn't know their work. One was Kate Bellis, who spent her life documenting the hill farmers in the Peak District. So knowing the area, I mean, lived nearby, her work is fascinating and it's got a very human side. I don't do people particularly. It's just not something which I think I'm that good at. But she was interesting. And as was someone called Jim Mortram. And I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
Now, he lives in a small town in Norfolk. And he documents the people, and like every small town, it's actually got a really significant degree of deprivation. So what I find fascinating about his work is where is the intersection with my day job, and him showing the human side of people who we get come to us as our patients every day, and that's fascinating. So what the stuff I'm looking at isn't actually necessarily the stuff which is inspiring me, or which is like what I'm taking.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, absolutely. It's like a kind of contrast between the two, yeah. It's, yeah, it's if we were just, it's almost like, it's kind of like opening, it's a bit like fantasy photography in a way. It's like kind of you open yourself up to, I don't know whether it actually makes a difference, but sometimes other photographers are just too good. And I don't have the patience or the time anymore to kind of invest. And one of the things I do a lot of these days is just use my phone to just grab something as I'm walking along the street, and then worry about it after. Photographically, they're terrible. But it's kind of like, you know, the last couple of images I've posted on Instagram have been like, you know, a collection of wheelie bins that were stuck in the middle of the street and blocking me way. And I just thought, you know, kind of, okay, it's got of seemingly no value. Was kind of, it's also quite important to capture that kind of stuff and figure out what's in front of us sometimes.
I very much admire people who do that, because I see photos, and I think you put that one on Twitter as well, actually, didn't you?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, and I see the value in that, but I know that if I take it, I'll see the scene, I'll take the photo, and then I'll look at it and go, but I can't do anything with that. And I really admire people who can take something so mundane.
Well, the trick is to be ruthlessly lazy. And that is all. That's my only motivation. Is, you know, I get the camera out, and I've got quite a nice camera, and it's like, yeah, I can't be bothered. It's like all the effort that you've got to put into it, and it's like, no, I'll just stand in, and I'll just press the button. It's like everything's on automatic these days. You know, it'd be wonderful sometimes. You do get something where you go, oh, it's actually reasonably artistic. But, you know, nine times out of ten, it's like, no. There's no effort goes into it whatsoever. So
yeah, I have to say, I mean, I have been doing quite a lot of, yeah, with the phone, just because it's what I've got with me when I'm walking around Peterborough. You know, just things like walking to the shop, to Sainsbury's, because, oh, I can't be able to get the car out and I need some exercise because I'm not doing anything else. So yeah, and around the autumn time, I was doing a lot of that sort of thing.
Do you find it comes in waves? It's like kind of you walk around for weeks or months with your camera, and you're taking loads of things, and then for another 6 months, you're really not, you know, you're not doing anything.
I do, definitely, yeah, and if I'm what catches my interest, will change. And as we said before, the thing that I've been actually had some time off with depression over the summer, the sort of late summer into autumn. And what I found was that the things I photographed got a lot more concrete, and I didn't have the will to try the abstracts and the fun stuff. I didn't have the will to do that at all. But as I kind of felt better, that started to come back into my photography, and I thought that was something that was only obvious when I was looking back, but I thought that was quite interesting.
So there'd been a kind of narrowing of sensitivity, if you like.
Yeah.
Or I suppose that defines what depression is in a way, isn't it? You know, I think
you're right, yeah. Everything's blunted. You just don't feel how vivid things are. And that was how it, yeah. So I ended up a lot of butterfly pictures, because they were just there in front of me. So while some of them I'm sort of reasonably happy with, it's not what really makes me feel satisfied.
Yeah, it's that kind of expectation, isn't it, that you... I think this is one of the interesting things about the lockdown. I'm quite introvert. I can cope by myself for relatively long periods of time, actually. Gets a bit frustrating at times, but, you know, I don't need to be... I like going out and about, but I don't need to be going out and about. So when you're looking at things, it can get a bit claustrophobic that you're looking at the same walls or you're looking at the same plants in your yard or wherever it is, and you kind of a longingness comes on. But then you kind of remind yourself that, one, it could be worse. Yeah, there are people living in, you know, in much worse conditions than perhaps you or I are. And two, to use your imagination a little bit more. And that's kind of your way out of that that narrowing of your sensitivities and your expectations, is that actually it allows you to dig in a little bit deeper into yourself rather than necessarily responding to stuff that's, you know, kind of keeping up with. Actually, that's a good phrase to use. Keeping up with people that we have, you know, that we think we want to be on a par with in terms of our photography expression.
Maybe I think you're right. I think that's quite a good way of looking at it. And imagination is certainly one way of, because, you know, making things look something else what they're not. You're right. I mean, I don't know how people who live in a flat, for example, you know, then that's ultimately claustrophobic, and certainly to have just a garden, have a bit of space outside, extremely grateful. But yeah, if you can't go physically, then you go in your mind.
Have you been watching, what have you, kind of TV and stuff like that? Have you been a binge watcher of Netflix, or are you fairly well behaved when it comes to endless hours of TV?
No, we don't tend to. One of the things that we've found is that it's really easy to get into a rhythm, and it's been a rhythm that's been sort of dictated by TV. So we find, right, we'll go for a walk, we'll have lunch. My husband's a northerner, he likes to have his lunch at 12, so and then we'll do something.
No, he has his dinner if he's from the north.
No, so yes, you're right, he has his dinner. Yeah. Well, see, to me, dinner is the main meal. Yeah. Doesn't matter what time of day it is, yeah, it's the main meal, but yeah, he has his dinner, you're right. And then at 3 o'clock, Voyage is on. And then at 4 o'clock, there's something else. And we sort of fell into this trap quite easily. And it's trying to get out of a little bit. So you're not, your life isn't dictated by what's on when. I'm not a binge watcher particularly. My secret pleasure, don't tell anyone this, is that Robin and Sherwood's been on. So I'm just catching up with that. Obviously, it hasn't been on since the mid-80s when I was at school. So, catching up with... and rewatching those at the moment.
That's the one with the son of, what's his name, who died?
Jason Connery. Connery. Yes.
That was it. Yeah, because there was another one, wasn't there? There was one in the noughties.
There was.
Yeah. There's, it's like kind of, you know, getting back into old episodes of, I've been watching old episodes of Doctor Who.
Right.
Tom Baker. Kind of, but I think they're well above par to the current. I don't mind Jodie Whittaker, but it's I don't like Steve Chibnall, the show producer. The stories are inane.
I wasn't that impressed. I haven't seen the New Year's Day episode, but I wasn't that impressed by the last series. So you're right, one or two of the stories were okay, but not. Yeah, some of them were just. Yeah, it didn't do much for me. Left me feeling a bit dissatisfied that you could have done a lot more.
So it means I took out a subscription for BritBox. Okay. So I've got endless hours of 1970s ITV, BBC comedies, 80s Channel 4 stuff. And I've no intention of watching any of them. So the one that came up, you know, the Christmas special, Minder on the Orient Express. And I thought, why am I subscribing to this? And it's so occasionally I can sit down, cook me dinner, cook me dinner, and I mean evening meal. I've been down here too long.
You have been, haven't you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Your tea,
cook me tea and sit down and watch an episode of, you know, I've gone through all the Star Trek episodes.
Yes. Yes.
So it's like, well, I must be really desperate if I get onto, you know, kind of Miss Marple or, you know, what, Hyacinth Bouquet or whatever it is.
Oh, God, yes, remember those. The ones that you'd rather, yeah, rather not remember. I mean, we've got Sky, but, you know, ITV3 and ITV4 have got quite a lot of those on. And there's a little diet of Star Trek every day.
And what are you up to on Star Trek? Voyager, you said?
Well, the original one. So one of the channels has basically got the original series on repeat, and then it's going through the older ones of the new stuff. So showing Enterprise at the moment, so I've seen most of those. But I haven't seen Picard and I haven't seen Discovery because obviously they're on ones on Netflix or Disney Plus or whatever. And there's not always anything to watch on, you know, with our 200 Sky channels. So I'm not sure I really want to pay any more for less to watch.
Yeah. I've got to the point of, with Netflix, it's a case of flicking through, looking for something, and you kind of, it keeps throwing up zombie movies and horror films, yeah. Neither of which I'm interested in. I think, you know, given the precariousness of our mental health at the moment, I don't want to be stuffing my head with kind of apocalyptic, you know, dystopian dramas.
No, about this disease that's rampaging around the world. No.
Yeah, you know, somebody wakes up in the morning and all of their friends have eaten each other. It's like, I don't want to see that, you know. I live in Leicester. If I want to see that, I'll go and step out and walk in the town centre, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I do know what you mean. I wouldn't believe the number of people that, when this all started, they said, oh, have you watched Contagion? It's like, no, and I'm not really intending to watch it either. It's a really good movie. No, thanks. There's enough going on.
Yeah, I have a job where I have to keep up with medical journals. I don't want to be watching this stuff. And it's finding stuff for kind of light entertainment. Because I ended up watching, I showed my partner, Ty, and I showed him an episode of The Good Life Christmas Special from 1975. You know, the one where Margot's Christmas doesn't get delivered or something like that. And I'm sitting there laughing my head off. But it's like I've reached that age where I really don't want social commentary. I just want kind of light chuckles over a gin and tonic.
Yeah, well, sci-fi will do that as well. Yeah, just something completely no relation to anything at all. But of course, because I've actually been working quite a lot, I haven't had that problem with the air of the long days stretching endlessly in front, because I have to get up and go to work.
And is that an advantage? I mean, obviously with the job that you're doing, it's quite stressful, and but is that routine, does that keep you going, or is it like, you know, you have to force yourself?
I'm fairly self-sufficient. You know, I can spend time on my own, but actually what's nice is going to work and seeing colleagues, seeing friends at work. And that has been, valuable. You know, I've got some very good friends at work. But what was strange, particularly during the first lockdown, a little bit during this, is that I'm going to work and everybody else isn't. And all the, the light entertainment, as you say, the radio, the comedies, are all where we're all stuck at home watching Netflix, trying to homeschool the kids. It's like, well, no, we're not all. And it felt very much during the first lockdown like there was a big glass window between me and the rest of the world. And I could see what was going on, but I couldn't take part in it. And that, it was a really strange feeling. It's not quite as much during this, and actually maybe because during this lockdown we've had Christmas period, which has just been strange for everybody, and actually I've had quite a lot of leave booked anyway for this quarter, so I haven't felt quite the same and quite as divorced from everybody.
I was of the opinion with the government advertising about the lockdowns is that they were largely aimed at a group of people who live in a leafy hometown, counties town, market town, who maybe drive an 18-month-old BMW and have good friends who are an estate agent and like to go to a Prosecco bar on a Friday evening. and so I found the kind of whole That's a really good description. Is kind of the expectation. What people have to go to jobs and have to work in factories and, you know, travel on public transport to get to those jobs. And it's like, yeah, you know, I saw lots of, kind of participated in some of them, of kind of policy organisations and voluntary service organisations kind of clapping themselves for how amazing it was that they were, they transformed their organisation on a tuppence to kind of repurpose all the work they were doing. And I'm like kind of sitting there going, yeah, but you get paid to do that. It's like, why are you clapping yourself for doing your job?
It's like, yes. I think you're right. I think there is, well, I mean, without getting too political about it, mean, but then there's...
We'll just read your Twitter feed for that,
yeah,
don't worry.
Yeah, please do. But a lot of this is, politics is important, but it does seem to me that the idea of lockdown, preventing people from having contact with other people, is the way to stop the virus replicating. That is how the virus reproduces, is by jumping between people. So we have to do that. But what you have to do is ensure that if you are doing it fairly and actually considering the people, everybody, what you have to do is make the correct thing to do the easiest thing to do. So you have to make sure that people who, and it's not just, you're right, I mean, people have to go to factories and things like that, but also there are people, for example, delivery drivers. Yeah, we're all sitting at home ordering off Amazon or whichever your sort of favoured marketplace is. But somebody's got to bring that to your door. And they can't just say, most of those are self-employed or 0 hours contract. They can't just self-isolate because they will have no money coming in. And some of the margins are so tight that they won't have savings. Because actually what is being done at the moment, without considering that side of things, the government is sort of making a nice area where the virus can replicate, can just quite happily go about its business between people, because some people have no choice but to mix.
Well, it's that argument, isn't it, that we need to deal with the virus so that the economy can recover. Mm. It's like, until we deal with the economy, we can't deal with the virus. And if a significant number of people cannot afford or, you know, to take time out and isolate, and they've got, you know, sick pay levels and threats of, you know, in 0 hours precarious employment, all that kind of stuff. If there's nobody standing there saying we are guaranteeing this, then nobody can follow the isolation rules.
Exactly. And I think to say that it's health or economy is a false dichotomy. The two are not mutually exclusive. Because, in fact, if you have an unhealthy population, they're not economically active. And you say you have a population that rely on the economics. You can't, on their job to get money in, so that can't afford to self-isolate. The two actually are very, very closely linked. They're not mutually exclusive, which is how they've been treated.
And how frustrating is that from you? From the point of view that you've been, you know, working at the front line, dealing with patients and dealing with people who are affected by it?
It makes me quite angry. We shouldn't be in this position now. Now, notwithstanding, it's winter. Winter was always going to be difficult because people are not out in the open air. People are inside. You know, they're closer contact. We knew that there would be some resurgence. But we shouldn't, given that the way the transmission works and it's sort of logarithmic, so, you know, one person infects, you know, produces two infections, produces four or eight, etc., instead of one person produces one infection which produces another one, you know, and it's not linear. We should be starting from a much lower baseline. We shouldn't have these numbers now, because what happened last year was inadequate and late. And it makes me very, very angry, because there's deaths that don't need to happen. There's people that can't get into hospital, where we should, you know, the hospitals are overrun. I'm sorry, I know there's people out there trying to deny this is happening, but they need to really open their eyes, because, you know, we have ambulances waiting to get into the hospital. We have people sitting in the emergency department for 18, 20 hours waiting for a bed, you know, in an environment that's getting more and more crowded, just because you're trying to shove more and more people in there, more patients in there. And we should not be in this position. We shouldn't have to be.
I think we've kind of, you know, described this as the cake and eat it society, which is you know, mm-hmm. it keeps getting repeated, and as if it's a reward, have your cake and eat it. And I don't think there's an understanding within our UK society, particularly, about the lack of capacity and the way that things have been run on. You know, there is no spare capacity. In fact, we're running things under capacity, and that's regarded as the way of delivering efficiency, is to run it under capacity rather than invest in systems and platforms and processes that actually improve capacity. We've got this very and trying to budge people's thinking on that. It's a very much. It must be very frustrating from a clinical practice point of view that you are having to explain to people that it's such a tight margin that if I go off sick, there might be one person to replace me, but if they go off sick, there's nobody. That's how narrow it is, and that's how close to collapse it could be.
It is, and you're right, but this is symptomatic of changes in society, and this change from a just-in-case, which we had, to just-in-time, means that every margin, every chain in that supply has to work, every cog has to be there, every person has to go to work, because we don't have the resilience. I hate the word resilience, where it's used as almost like a increase, increase your armor, you get hit more. But actually, what we should be doing is increasing system resilience. But of course, that's not economically efficient. That requires a little bit more money, and this will to pare everything down to the bone. This is true with all public services, criminal justice system, education, social services. Everything is pared to the bone, pared to the bone. Can we make more savings? Because that's been the last 10 years political reality. So it's just made the societal change. It's compounded that. I remember having a conversation with my brother, who was working on the railways, working for one of the train operating companies a few years ago, saying, on a train, if they had more than 85% occupancy, there was questions asked about safety, and there was an attempt to try and prevent that happening again. Whereas, in ours, they actually 85%. Well, why haven't we got 95% occupancy? Why haven't we filled the rest of those beds? Why do we have 15 beds out of 100 not filled? Well, the truth is that you need to be able to cope with surges. You need to have the time between patients. Simple things like cleaning beds, ensuring that staff get their breaks and things like that. Actually, you to run at, say our hospital's running at 99-100% occupancy now, doesn't allow for the natural changes, the natural cycles, the surges and things that we know happen. And it does. And this systematic running down of public services does make me very angry.
The other side of it as well is the lack of public education. My exasperation is when I walk around, something's failed with the community. My interest is communications, and something's failed about the communications process in terms of wearing masks, washing hands, basic hygiene. And what you described as, the understanding of something like viral load, the more time that you spend with somebody with this virus, it's not that you get infected once and that's it, you got it. It increases. The more time you spend with somebody in close quarter with somebody, your infection rate increases. I'm not particularly good at describing these things. I'm not from a medical background, but that's as I understand it. But that basic principle is not widely understood or communicated.
I completely agree with you. We boil everything down to, and this is part of the problem, is that we don't deal with complexity well. Everything has to be simplified. Every message has to be simplified. So somebody can't do something good and bad. They're either fated for, you're a hero for doing something good, or you're a villain because you've done something bad. Well, actually, the truth is we're all in between. But everything has become so simplified that complexity is just not ignored. And I suspect that's why we boil it down to this masks, face, space, whatever your slogan is, But you're right, we don't acknowledge that things are a little bit more complicated than that, and life is more complicated.
I'm just trying to bridge a concept in my head about, is this something that you've kind of, you know, you said you took time off work. Is the, that, if you like, that concrete scientific knowledge that you deal with on a daily basis, the biomechanical knowledge that you have to manage the process, and that's part of the job of a physician and a healer. That when you described earlier that kind of point where you got to where your photography was just became very concrete, it boiled it down to its basic state, and you lost the nuances, and you lost the shade and the I'm trying to find some better words to describe, but you'd lost the bits at the edges that kind of add to things, and our education process about this has been reductive and functional, and it doesn't allow for any creative or expressionistic kind of a response. It's very, you must do this, you must do that. And then naturally, in that circumstance, some people are pushing, however ill-informed and ill-intented, some people are pushing back against that because there's no latitude to learn and understand from it.
It's an interesting parallel, actually, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it was certainly true that people would become tired of what, of life being very different, and things would relax a bit just because we're human. But I think, the question is, why?
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder if our healthcare, it kind of bridges, we need to bridge that gap and look at creativity as an indicator of well-being.
Creativity costs though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In money, it costs in energy.
It doesn't. I mean, a walk along the canal and take some photos. Is that going to cost a lot?
It costs in mental energy, I think.
But and if you're depleted of that mental energy, that's what I mean. It's like it's an indicator that you're not functioning as well, or somebody's not functioning as well as they could be, because they don't have that extra mental energy and capacity to step back and look at things. You get locked in a defensive mode. And the dangers collectively, both individually and collectively, that's kind of feels to me like we're at. So what I'm making the case for is that we actually need to get out of it. We need to keep and maintain our creative spirits.
We do. And that's, I mean, where I sort of touched on this concept of resilience. To be able to deal with things, yes, we have to have the capacity. But I think it's easy to say that. But I think, and it's sort of easy to do when you're functioning well. But when the system isn't functioning, it be that a person or a societal system, whatever. It's very hard because you never get the chance to get your head up above the parapet and say, right, I've got time to do this, because you are just continually surviving.
You're in that defence mode rather than that outward looking mode. I think the bridge between these things, actually, it's two sides. It's the yin and the yang, isn't it? It's the two sides of the same thing. Is that we a lot of the managerialist efficiency based processes reject creative practices and outlooks, but we know that actually that's an indicator of to what level people's well-being, creative well-being, is an indicator of their general social well-being. And the two go hand in hand, so we need to keep practicing them both.
I think we do, but I think we've got an environment that makes it harder for whatever reason, so being it bit economic. And you just, you're working two jobs, you're trying to keep food on the table, be it mental health, that you say you personally can't. And it's to allow that. And basically what I think people need is some space. And say in whatever way you want to, so money, financial space or whatever, to actually be and be permitted to be creative.
I think we might look back at this period and kind of go, why didn't we just take the pressure off ourselves? You know, it's like, it's just, we know we're going to have to pay for it. But for this point, for the next couple of years, we really need to just know that we, you know, we've got our, somebody, the system's got our back, and that we can rely on it and that we don't have to worry.
Yeah.
Sounds impossibly, you know, idealistic, but, you know, it's like, that's what our government should be there to do, you know, to say, not admonish us and whip us and say, you do know all of this needs to be paid for. And we go, yeah, we know.
Yes.
But for just the time being, let us just deal with this first and then we'll worry about the other stuff later.
I think absolutely right. I think there is a time, there's a time and a place to say, right, we've got to pay for this, but I don't think it's now. But I guess the flip side of this is that again, and this comes down to sort of the political side, is that people are out to make money from whatever, well, from us, aren't they? And I think that will always, that pressure is won't go away, because that is the way our system is set up. And if that money stops flowing, then the system breaks. So, you know, to have a more caring system. It's very much like a machine at the moment, isn't it? And it's very much what, I don't know how to explain what I'm trying to say.
Well, maybe maybe this is a subject for another podcast later on.
Maybe, yes. This is certainly not a distraction, is it?
Yeah, you know, well, no, but it's I think it's important to, the thing I like about the space that you can create in a podcast like this, where you don't put any kind of rules or pattern, you know, kind of outcomes that you want, is that it allows us to just think a little bit and take our time and kind of say, actually, you know, that, and there is a lot of work about kind of caring models. And I wonder, you know, kind of in broader terms, we're shifting from a kind of a model of, I think, from a kind of masculine, use these terms very kind of guardedly, but masculinized, you know, go get them, winner takes all, power politics, that kind of stuff, to a more feminized, caring model, which is based around the idea of a kind of a goodness politics, which is about, you know, nurturing rather than winning, you know, and you know, we need to think this through, and we need to create the spaces where we can have these kind of conversations where it's like, and what our personal experience contributes to that is respected and matters, not just being, you know, because you can't measure it, you know, that walk that you take along the river and you see, you know, the heron on the side or wherever it is, lifts your spirit, but you couldn't put that into a plan for a social prescription budget, you know, can't do that, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right, but unfortunately I think, and this comes down to our political administration at the moment, that is not what they are. I think it's very interesting that when you look at a lot of people who are hit, being hit financially by the last year and the way the pandemic's been managed, is that a large number of them are women. The women are in the lower paid jobs. Women are more likely to be in hospitality or retail. You think of a, you know, even sort of people, as you say, people in the leafy suburbs, you know, having to, who are working at home, actually a lot of them are expected to be doing their job and also to be schooling the children, or at least looking after the children.
The virus might not know class distinctions, but our response does.
Yes, our response does.
Gender and class and race distinctions, But the only thing I would say is, don't worry, this lot won't be around forever.
Oh, we can hope.
You know, we've got to start getting into that kind of mindset, I think. I think we've kind of allowed them enough latitude. And it's kind of now we're saying, yeah, we're thinking beyond you now, guys. You know, you've had a chance and you're kind of not, you know, you're failing, basically.
It would be nice, wouldn't it, to think that there is an alternative. But I think that it's not, maybe not feminising, but it's actually, I guess the word is more just inclusive.
Yeah.
That we have the masculine and the feminine and whatever in between. But those viewpoints are being recognised.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, that's what we very much need. In in our leadership. But doesn't
well,
seem
well
to
it's
be, yeah.
It's telling, isn't it, that you know the vast majority of the cabinet are men. You know,
yeah.
And the you know we've seen one woman in do any of the press conferences in three months, and so I think it does play. I think it does play a big part in it. And the country, a lot of the, I don't know whether this is still true because it's obviously things move on. But the countries that have done better have a higher proportion of women in senior posts. So
yes, yeah.
Yeah,
and
hopefully that emboldens people. So let's finish off with a kind of positive thing. What are you looking forward to doing this weekend creatively? Are you back in work next week or is
back
it?
Back at work next week, yes.
So you've got a few days where you kind of go, right, I'm going to make the most of this now. What are you planning?
Yes.
You're going to be in the dark room? Are you going to be in the garden? Are you going to be out for a walk?
I'm definitely out for a walk, intending to do a longer one. Somewhere, and if the weather lets us, I want to do this sort of join a couple of the loops together, which be sort of 14-15 miles. So I'm hoping to get out and do that. I think that's sort of most of the plan. And the other thing, I guess, again, being creative is that I'll need to start. I need to make a cake and do sort of baking and get some cooking done. I'm very fortunate. We definitely have a proper division of labour. But my husband does the cooking when I'm at work. I think I need to do my fair share.
You can make the occasional treat.
Exactly. I make the cakes. And I have been. And that's one of the things I was doing, I've been doing throughout last year. And, you know, is quite a lot of baking. I like baking because you get to eat it. It's an ideal creative activity.
Good.
So,
it's hands on as well. So it sounds great.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to see your photos and follow your views and your retweets?
Well, Twitter.
And you are on Twitter as?
I am on Gala1871.
I'll put a link in the blog as well with the post.
That's probably the best place, I think.
Brilliant. So, well, it's been lovely chatting. And
Really nice.
Yeah, and we'll do it again at some point soon. We'll maybe grab a couple of people together, get a coffee, and just moan about what's on Netflix.
Or on Sky.
Otherwise,
I'll have to get Netflix.
Yeah, I have Netflix, I don't have Sky. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
So this has been a Distraction Therapy podcast with me, Rob Watson. If you want to get in contact with me, you might want to sit and have a chat like this at some point. I'm very happy to do that. It's just look for me on Twitter and Instagram at Rob W Media. But until next time, thank you very much.
This is a Distraction Therapy podcast. Whatever gets you through the day.